Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and good afternoon, everybody, on a nice warm Saturday afternoon here in Chicago. Welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. TJ Cruz, the founder of Cyber Protection Services. They are one of the top cybersecurity firms based in the Baltimore, Maryland area. TJ, thanks for your time, and let's go and get started, please.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's go ahead. We looked up your bio. We did some background snooping on you, of course, is what, you know, what we always do here. And you seem to have quite a wide range of skills and background within IT, cybersecurity. Can you elaborate more on your career highlights and kind of what led you to the path that you are now in today?
Of course. So when I was in high school, there was a new program that was started called the Da Vinci program, where they brought in technology and interfaced it with English and history and how it all came to pass. And this pilot program brought in several computers, and this was, of course, before the internet. So during that time, I learned programming. I learned about computers, how they work, how they are put together, DOS 3.0, for those of you that may remember that, you know. And I found kind of a real liking to it. Not only did I like it, I seemed to pick up on it fairly quickly. And so after that, my technological career kind of exploded, and I ended up at one of the dot-coms in Silicon Valley working on some software that essentially does self-healing. So back in the day, if you deleted a DLL by mistake and you would have to reinstall the entire program, this was around 2000, this software actually identified that you were missing the DLL and just put the DLL back rather than having to reinstall the program. So it was a fairly popular product. And then 9/11 happened, and I decided to change careers and go in the military. I ended up going in the Navy, where I became an IT and kind of really honed my IT skills, learning about networks, developing networks, troubleshooting networks. And from there, I shifted because the Navy came out with this new rate called CTN, Cryptological Technician Networks. And essentially all centered around cybersecurity. And so I was transferred out to Maryland, worked on my security technological background, I guess, if you will, and brought my IT expertise to bear. And it was also during that time I got my project management certification. So after leaving the military, I became a program manager for a large cybersecurity firm in the D.C. area and worked there for a couple of years working with federal clients on how to strengthen their cybersecurity posture, and decided to kind of venture out on my own and create a cybersecurity company, because one of the things I realized is there was very few companies that catered to the small business. A lot of the cybersecurity companies, you know, Booz Allen's, your Deloitte's, your Accenture's, those were really geared towards federal government, and those were the ones that were considered subject matter experts in cybersecurity. But for the small businesses, I'm talking anywhere from the two-man shop all the way up to 50 people, those companies were kind of priced out. And so I wanted to develop a company to help small businesses shore up their security, because one wrong cybersecurity attack would cripple or put someone out of business after they've worked really, really hard. So Cyber Protection Services was born.
Congratulations. Just a couple of side questions here. I'm a kind of I've got a strong interest in like military history. Just out of curiosity, what kind of ships? What were the names of the ships that you served on? Were they like aircraft carriers or?
I never served on an aircraft carrier. I served on a cruiser, different spelling name, of course, not cruise, but a cruiser. and I was actually only on one ship, the USS Antietam. I was there for, I actually ended up doing two tours on the Antietam. I extended my time there. And then once I shifted to become a CTN, I transferred to Shore Command. So it was primarily the only ship I was on, but had a real good time there. I was there for a number of years.
Well, I just want to tell you, thank you for your military service. And another side question I had was, I noticed that you have a CISSP certification. Is that correct?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
What is the now? I get a lot of questions asked about the CISSP, like its value today, and it's really worth it. Just if you can take a couple of seconds and just talk about the value it has brought to you, and for our subscribers that might be interested in CISSP.
I absolutely will. So CISSP, Certified Information Security Professional, is considered an international stamp of approval that you really know cybersecurity. And let me kind of explain what I mean by that. So the CISSP is proctored and given out by ISC Squared. ISC Squared is a nonprofit. They are recognized all over the world, but their teaching and certification methods are some of the best in the industry. There are certain certifications that you can get, and I won't name any specifics, but most people will know that what I'm talking about if they try to go after certifications, where you can go online, download the answers to the test, memorize the test, take it, and you got your certification. That doesn't mean you really know anything about the material. It shows that you can actually memorize the test. But the CISSP and pretty much any certification that ISC Square proctors has several levels that you have to go through to ensure that you not only know the material, but understand and comprehend the material rather than just memorizing facts and figures. So in order to be a CISSP, there are several different steps. First step is, of course, you have to learn the material and understand it. Then you have to take, it used to be a six-hour test. They've actually changed it to where it's now adaptive, where if you learn, if you know one section and you can prove you know one section, they're not going to ask you 75 questions on that one section. They'll move to the next section. But if you don't know that section, you'll continue to get more questions on that section. So, but the test that I took was actually the full six-hour test and 250 questions. And you are ID'd. You are kept in a room and proctored by an ISC Squared professional trainer. They make sure that you don't have anything on you. You can't even go to the bathroom unless you are basically followed. And then once you are complete with that test, you have to pass it with a 700, if memory serves. It's been a while since I've taken the test, but you have to pass it as a 700. If you don't pass it, they give you a number and show you where the sections are that you need to brush up on. And once you've taken the test and haven't passed it, you have to wait a certain amount of time to take it again. If you don't pass it a second time, I believe it's 6 months for the third time, and please fact check me on that because it's been a while since I've looked at the rules, but this is the rules that I remember when I went through it. And then if you don't pass it a third time, you have to wait even longer to take it again. So it's not like you can just keep going in and taking the test. Once you've passed the test, then you have to go find someone who has the certification and ask them to sponsor you. This person has to sign under essentially the oath, the ISC Squared oath, that they know who you are, they acknowledge that you have had at least 5 years' experience in the security field. So if you don't have the 5 years' experience but you still pass the test, you've passed the CISSP, but you're not the full certification. You're kind of the apprentice. But if you get the 5 years in and you get somebody to acknowledge that you've had the 5 years in and sign, someone who already has their certification, then you are bestowed upon the CISP certification. And then, of course, every 3 years, you have to stay on top of it by doing podcasts, attending podcasts, writing papers, listening to some training, and get your CPEs every 3 years in order to maintain that certification.
Wow. Sounds like getting like a master's degree almost. Anyway.
It really is. It was a difficult test.
Yeah, I tried taking that, I think in 2002 or 3, and I just didn't get through the practice. But anyway, congratulations on that too. It's a big achievement. But let's go back to your company. So how did you actually venture into cyber protection services? Can you give us more detail on that? And is it a new startup, or is it something that's kind of been around for a while that you've done aside, now it's like mushroomed into a full-time thing now?
Well, I've only been out of the military since 2016, so essentially only 4 years. And, of course, the first couple of years were spent as a program manager for another cybersecurity company. So when I ventured out on my own, I was primarily focused on the commercial space. And when I say that, I was looking for small businesses to kind of help them and teach them digital self-defense. And what I mean by digital self-defense, you can have all the programs in the world, you can have all the locks in the world, you can have the best security system in the world. However, if you don't know some of the basics, cyber threats can still be realized. You can still have people attack you successfully. So I wanted to help small businesses that way. So while I was doing that, I had met a few clients, and I was, you know, starting to pick up some steam. And this was in 2018, summertime 2018. And as I was doing that, I was actually contacted by a company called Deloitte. And if you've ever heard of Deloitte, you know they're a multi-billion-dollar international company, and they're a services company. They offer multiple different types of services. They had they were about to bid on a federal contract, a multi-million-dollar federal contract, and with a federal agency. And I had worked with that federal agency in the past, and because of the work that I had already done at that federal agency, Deloitte asked me and Cyber Protection Services to be a subcontractor for theirs. And this was a huge honor, because Deloitte rarely, if ever, uses small companies. When I say small, less than 100 people, and even more rare do they work with startups. But because of the work that I had done with the team while I was there, they knew my reputation, they knew the things that I brought to the table, and the value that, you know, I helped other people realize at this federal agency. And so one thing led to another, and we ended up becoming one of their subcontractors on this federal contract, because they did successfully win that contract and a lot of the task orders that were on it. So we've kind of been focusing on that, making sure that that's staffed appropriately. And as all this came to fruition, this was between the beginning of 2019 and through pretty much September, October of 2019, that's really what we're focusing on with staffing this contract. So as that kind of wrapped up and things started settling down, we started working again towards our core market, which was the commercial space. And from there, we were reaching out to small businesses, starting to get a name for ourselves, and then, of course, the coronavirus hit and things kind of came grinding to a halt. So we've been focusing on just streamlining a lot of processes, really just trying to work and make our value add better. And therefore, when things start to go back to normal, we'll be ready for pretty much anything that comes our way. And while we were doing that, we were actually reached out to by the Center for Internet Security, and we just completed a project with them having to do with their benchmarks. So, and that was just finished up last week, and that was very successful as well. So we've been really doing some excellent work in terms of cybersecurity.
Excellent. Congratulations. That sounds like all wonderful news. Now, how long have you been in business, And how has the COVID ID impacted your business model?
So as I mentioned, technically I've been around for a little over a year, and the COVID-19 impacted us because one of our key strengths is going to small companies, asking them questions, almost interviewing them, trying to understand their unique situation and their unique landscape, and then giving them a customized security solution. Not all security is created equal. And so one of the things that COVID-19 kind of prevented us was we weren't able to actually go and do the interviews because we wanted to comply with CDC guidelines. So really over the last 60 to 90 days, as this situation evolved, we've been kind of rescheduling our time with our prospective new customers and really focusing on our products and our processes and making sure that our people stayed safe and healthy as well.
Okay. Now, who is your typical customer base? It sounds like the federal government's pretty much your customer base, or do you you obviously reach out to SMBs also. But do you reach out to Fortune 500, or is it a combination of all three?
There's a lot of Fortune 500 companies out there, and there's a lot of companies in that space. Believe it or not, our customer base are really the small businesses. I try to steer away from any companies that have over 100, 150 people because there are other companies in that space that, you know, have higher price tags, and those companies are easily found. The companies that I want to help, because I believe that cybersecurity should be available to any company, really, for that matter, any person, we focus on the smaller companies so that we can customize our solutions and be very efficient when offering those services. So, give you an example, you can have a law firm, 15, 20 people. You might get, you know, a dozen cases a month or so. Well, you're not going to need to spend tens of thousands of dollars on cybersecurity, which some of the bigger companies will do, because, you know, you've got an IT firm that is making sure your computers work, and those overhead dollars are precious. So what my company does is we come in, identify the strengths, improve the strengths if possible, and then shore up the missing pieces in one way or another, however they may need it. Maybe they need more training. Maybe they need some upgrades. We teach them not only how they can kind of maintain their own security posture, but also how to improve it. That has been where we've been very, very successful, and there's been a lot of companies that need those services, but really there hasn't been a good solution for them, at least not in the area we're in. There hasn't really been a good solution for them other than one of the bigger companies that won't even talk to you unless you have $100,000 to spend.
Right. Okay. Now let's get into your product and service line here. It sounds like you have distinct lines in professional business services, cyber training, personal cyber services, remote tech support, cybersecurity compliance, and auditing. And out of that, I would like for you, if you can give us some more insight into all of these, but I am a little bit more interested in, like, the compliance that comes with the capability maturity model, and also with your remote tech support, and how you're dealing with that with all this work-from-home issues.
All right, so let's talk about the compliance first off. The compliance models, there's several of them out there, but compliance really is based on drive of the company and where they fall into their product services. For example, federal governments are required to be in compliance with FISMA, and that's the Federal Information Security Management Act of 2002. So those are federal government agencies. Healthcare providers or anybody that has to work with healthcare information has what they call PHI, public health information, or I'm sorry, private health information. They are governed by HIPAA. And then you've got organizations that are in California. California has their own compliance requirements. And then you've got companies in the UK that are governed by GDPR, a new compliance model. But there is no specific compliance for state or local government, as strange as it may sound, unless, you know, California is the only one that's actually passed a compliance doctrine thus far. But my belief is every state will get to that point within the next 3 to 5 years. And so if there's no compliance driven, a lot of people think of security as an extra or one of those things that they don't really need to worry about until they get attacked. And so one of the things that we do is we come in, we identify what it is that where the risks are for that particular company. And one thing a lot of companies don't realize, especially companies that store, process, or do anything with client data, and that is, I mentioned a law firm earlier, take a law firm, they may end up getting your private information as far as your social security number, which is considered PII or personal identifiable information. They may get some of your health information. They may get other things, your financials, or any other sensitive data. If that data ends up becoming compromised, and when I say compromised, there's a couple different ways it can be compromised. Either confidentiality, meaning somebody's looking at it that shouldn't be. Integrity, it's changed without authorization. So if you have financials that say you have $100,000 in the bank and all of a sudden that data then shows $10,000 in the bank, that's a problem. And confidentiality, integrity, and availability, if you can't get to that information when you need to, so the server that you're trying to get to is down, one of those compromised states hits, what is the impact going to be on either the business or the clients or a combination of the two? And so one of the things that companies don't realize is if you're capturing client data and holding that client data or doing anything with that client data, and that data were to become compromised through your system, you actually can be held legally liable if you don't show due diligence. And due diligence is a very vague, but it's a legal term. It means that you have to prove to either a judge or a jury that your company did everything in their power correctly to protect that data. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's a huge conversation up for a lot of debate. But I can tell you some of the highlights. If you're not training your staff on how to look out for cyber threats, that's a problem. If you're not using strong protections, meaning strong passwords or encryption or anything like that, that's a problem. Or if you're using personal devices to access that data, and those personal devices, let's say your home computer, and then you have a child that uses that computer, and suddenly they go to the wrong site and download malware, now all of a sudden that data has become compromised on a personal computer, that's a problem. These are just a couple of examples of not performing due diligence, and therefore that company could become legally liable in a court of law. So it really depends on the data you're capturing, what you're doing with it, and what the impact would be if and when it were to become compromised. So that's kind of what we do, is we look at the entire company holistically. Do we need to look at compliance? Do we need to look at are they potentially liable? And how can we help them by maximizing their resources and those precious overhead dollars? And you mentioned the cybersecurity compliance maturity model that just came out, or CMMC. So this is a new compliance-driven initiative that any company that does business with the Department of Defense and captures CUI, which is confidential but unclassified information, that infrastructure that captures that CUI must be compliant with the CMMC model. Now, it could be a contractor, it could be a subcontractor, but pretty much any business that touches that data has to follow this doctrine. And if they don't, they run the risk of losing the contract with the federal government and not being able to get that contract back because of that CMMC compliance requirement. This just came out in January of this year, the first version of it, and they don't even have auditors out yet. However, they do highly recommend that any company that may fall into this category get as compliant internally as they can, maybe work with a company like Cyber Protection Services to come in, get things set up so that when auditors actually are certified and actually are ready to go out and do the audits, it's a much easier audit process versus waiting until those auditors are certified and then all of a sudden you're scrambling to get everything ready because you're on a deadline. I kind of look at it like, you know, the IRS eventually is going to audit you. Waiting to hire an accountant to straighten out your books a month before the audit's probably not the right time. Doing it as early as possible and getting your company as set up as possible before that audit is always the best practice.
Okay. Can you expand more on your other products and services?
Of course. So you mentioned remote services. We offer remote tech support. And when I say remote tech support, that could be a phone call. That could be a web interface. That could be us coming in and actually modifying things on your computer with your permission, of course. We pretty much take every call in on a case-by-case basis. We do IT tech support, some basic tech support. We're not going to rebuild your network for you remotely, but we can certainly help you unlock a backup data or figure out why you're getting an error. And if it becomes a problem where we can't actually log into the system, and this is really more IT-based, not cybersecurity-based, but it's one of the ways we kind of pay the bills is we can do this remote tech support. We'll even come and pick up the computer, bring it back to our office, fix it up, and bring it back to you at no additional charge, provided you're within the, you know, local Maryland area.
Okay, excellent.
And then as far as the other services, we build out cybersecurity programs when it comes to, you know, a system security plan you might need. You might need a backup and recovery plan or a disaster recovery plan. Whatever those services may have to do, we can pretty much offer you. One thing we do not do is we don't do any programming. We don't do penetration tests. We don't do any things like those types of services because we're really trying to just help people build out the security infrastructure.
Okay, excellent. Now, are these offerings made available through the cloud, like your AWS or Azure, or do you do this on-prem, or is it a combination of both?
It's a combination of both. AWS cloud is really a way to store data. We will work with a company that may store data on that cloud, but our services really are helping develop that security program that a business may need. It's not necessarily a program as far as an application or a piece of software that we offer. It's really that one-on-one training. Think of it like your trainer at the gym, right? We're going to be the ones to show you how to do a proper push-up. We're going to be the ones to show you how to do a proper squat. We're also going to show you what can happen if you don't do the proper push-up or proper squat. And those services are ongoing. We also offer cybersecurity training where we've got a partner with InfoSec where we can actually give you an entire cybersecurity training program that everybody in your company can be a part of. They watch it. They watch some videos, answer some questions, and they get new content every month because, like any other training, you have to stay up with the latest cyber threats. And one of the things that we have found is some of the biggest threats to any company are the insider threat. Those are the employees that you have. That's not to say that they're trying to attack their companies. I mean, we've seen those too, but for the most part, it's they lack the knowledge of how to avoid falling into traps. We just had a client about 2 weeks ago, actually, fell for this trap where he went to a website, it jumped up on his computer, that his computer was infected, and he needed to call Microsoft right away. So he contacted Microsoft. Turns out it wasn't Microsoft, it was a scam, and that person asked to log into his computer to be able to, quote, fix it. And oftentimes when that happens, if they're successful and the person says, okay, please come in and fix my computer, they end up encrypting the entire hard drive and then doing ransomware and charging that person to get their data back. We see this very, very often. So one of the things that is very easy to do to fix that is you teach your staff the proper procedure if XYZ happens. If you come to a website and it says your computer's infected, do nothing else. Try to shut down your computer and notify your IT support or notify us, being the cybersecurity managed service provider. We'll come in, we'll look at it, and if it is in fact infected, we'll clean the infection and restore the data to the best of our ability. If you don't teach your staff to do that, they tend to panic and can actually cause bigger problems. Another good example is we helped a senior living facility. This was before the coronavirus hit. We helped a senior living facility. They had an MSP, managed service provider, handle their IT services. They were transitioning to a new MSP. However, they still had 5 or 10 old computers that were connected with this MSP. Now, one of the things that's important is when you use any company, with the exception of maybe Microsoft, if you use any company that is maintaining your IT services, oftentimes what they'll do is they'll put their own software in so that they can remote into your computer to patch them, update them, unlock accounts. You have to do that in order to, you know, handle hundreds, if not thousands, of computers at a time. Well, this old MSP still had their software installed on 5 or 10 different computers. That MSP ended up getting hacked, and they essentially spread an infection of this malware through every one of their clients' data, including this customer that still had 5 or 10 computers that had their remote software in it. And those 5 or 10 computers were absolutely locked and encrypted. Nothing could happen on them. And the attacker asked for $100,000 in Bitcoin to have the unlock code to be able to get at least these 5 or 10 computers plus all the other clients that this MSP was handling. And they ended up paying $100,000 in order to get the crypto key and had to go to every one of their customers and help them unlock their computers individually. It was a nightmare for them. Thankfully, this customer that only had the 5 or 10 computers, we were able to actually come in, wipe the machines clean, restore their data because they'd already had a good disaster recovery plan in place. And then, of course, the other machines that were already on the new MSP were not affected, so we were able to help them fairly quickly. And it was on Christmas Eve that we had to do this. So it was a long night, but they were very, very happy once we were completed because they had the right security plan in place.
Okay. Excellent. Now, do you have any other customer success stories that you'd like to share with us? And can you tell us, you know, of course, leaving their name out, how one of them has actually benefited from your services, from your company?
I will. So we had a company. It was actually one of our first commercial clients that had three different locations, but they had 35 different employees. And a lot of those employees worked remotely. And they ended up contacting us because one of the employees believed their system had malware on it. Turns out, not only did they have malware on it, but they had key logging software and a variety of other things that just shouldn't have been there. And it did get infected throughout all of the different machines. So we were able to go in there, identify the particular malware. Thankfully, it was an older malware, so it was easily removed. We put them on a new antivirus solution. We were able to restore all of their data, and we were able to do some forensics, and we found that very little of their data had been compromised, although had they waited a little bit longer to contact us, it's possible that all of their data would have been exfilled. And so that data wasn't exfilled. We were able to squash the threat and put them on a new security plan, and so far, in the last 12 months, they've had many attempts of cyber attackers trying to get into their systems, and none of them have been successful according to the monitoring software that we use to scan them.
Now, TJ, let me ask you a question. I mean, obviously, there are many other, I don't know about many other, but there are other cyber vendors that probably offer along the same lines of services that you have, other tangential offerings. Why should a customer come to you and say, hey, TJ, I've looked at all these other companies, but I want to come to you to for you for my security needs? What, in other words, what separates you from the other vendors? What's your differential advantage in that regard?
Our differential advantage is we promote teaching digital self-defense in an uncertain world. And that's because cyber threats evolve every day. It's a lot like COVID-19, believe it or not, where that virus has mutated from the common cold. Cyber threats mutate all the time as technology changes, as new software solutions are introduced. Cybersecurity is constantly needing to be updated. Think of it back when, 50 years ago, we didn't have digital cameras that could capture somebody knocking at the door, ringing our doorbell. Now, Ring has those things, and they're easy to install. Well, that's because threats started to increase and break-ins started to increase. So new security methods had to be invented. Well, one of the things that separates cyber protection services is not only do we create customized and unique cybersecurity services for each one of our customers, but we also teach them of how to manage those cybersecurity programs, how to teach their own employees, or maybe you teach one of the employees and then they can teach, the other 25 employees, where other companies are looking to capture as much money as they can rather than building that long-term relationship. Our key to success is our interaction with our clients, the trust they give us, because you're not just going to have anyone come into your home and set up a security system, just like you shouldn't have just anybody come into your business and set up a cybersecurity system. We respect that trust that you're offering us. We understand that it doesn't come lightly. So we want to give you the highest value that we possibly can so you can save as much of that overhead money as you can so you can offer your employees bonuses or whatever it is that you do to make your company grow bigger. Because cybersecurity is not going to allow your company to grow bigger. We know that. So if we're able to help you stay away from the cyber threats as much as possible, and you continue to grow by that money that you're saving and by, you know, that peace of mind that you get that comes from knowing that you have a trusted partner, then you're going to continue to use our services and we're going to grow with you. So that's kind of where we differ from the big guys, where they just want to come in, you know, yep, thanks for the money. We put in this plan. Here it is. Call us in a year when you need more cybersecurity training. That's not how we want to do business, which is why we focus on the smaller businesses, even the home user, if necessary.
Excellent. Now let's segue over just into the cybersecurity landscape in general. Now that we have an excellent insight into what you do and what your company is all about, I got to be honest with you. I've been writing about cybersecurity for probably the last 10, 12 years, and I was at a networking event maybe about a month ago before all the shelter-in-place took effect. Somebody asked me, what is cybersecurity? And believe it or not, as much as I've written about it and as much podcast as I've done, I had to take some time to think about that. You know, what do I tell this person, you know, on a level that they can understand? What is cybersecurity in your opinion? Can you give us like a loose catch-all definition for our audience that may not even understand it completely?
Cybersecurity is the same definition that you would get for any security term that you can use. Call it personal security, call it home security. That cyber piece is the only difference. And essentially what you're doing is you're protecting information. Knowledge is power. Information is power. By protecting that information, you kind of maintain that knowledge base or that power base. So think of the sum of any business can be essentially broken down into how they have been successful, what made them successful. Now, that could be a business that created the new widget that has a patent and how they created that widget. It could be Coca-Cola, where they have a trade secret, that recipe for Coca-Cola. It could be, you know, any number of ways that a business is successful boils down to the information that they are either processing, storing, or doing something with. Now, 50 years ago, that information, for the most part, was in paper. So what would you do? You would make sure that you had locks on the doors or locks on the filing cabinets. You would make sure that you had copies stored somewhere in case there was a fire. You would need to make sure that information was secure in some way. Now that information is in ones and zeros and stored electronically for the most part, you need to find a way to protect that information. And again, it boils down to the three things that I had mentioned earlier: confidentiality, integrity, or availability. Information does you no good if it needs to remain secret or confidential and everybody can see it. Integrity, if information is changed, or, you know, think of a paper you did for college. If somebody only left one page and it was a 10-page paper, that paper is pretty much going to get an F because 9 of the pages were deleted. That's the integrity of that information. And if you can't get to that information when you need to access your bank account, you need to access those health records, you need to access some type of information in order to do whatever it is that you're trying to do at that moment. If it's not there, that's availability. If one of those three things becomes compromised, information itself has been compromised, and could have some impact. Now, it could be a light impact. It could be a detrimental impact. If the nuclear launch codes for the football were to fall into the wrong hands, confidentiality, that would be a bad thing. And I think anyone that has information that they need to keep protected for one reason or another, it's not always they need to keep it secret, but they need to keep it protected for one way or another, that has to have cybersecurity if it's maintained on some sort of electronic device.
Okay, now, another question to segue off of this one is, I think when, like, the SMB, even this, for me, is even pretty average American citizen, when they hear about a cyber threat, you know, attacking their home network, they'll probably just do a quick Google search, and of course, there'll be a bunch of product pushes from different vendors about how their products can protect your network or your home or your computer even more. Should people go in a buying frenzy and buy all the latest security products? Another issue that kind of stems from this, if you extrapolate this question to corporate America, like the bigger Fortune 500 companies, is that there used to be this mentality among CISOs and CIOs that there is safety numbers. So meaning the more, like, for example, firewalls you have out there, the better the lines of defenses are. But, of course, you know, they've bought so many different products from so many different vendors, you know, they're bloated. Now their cybersecurity team is so overwhelmed with all these alerts and messages and, you know, what have you. And now it's not only increasing the attack service for the cyber attacker. So now there's a shift in mentality now with the CIOs and CISOs of these much bigger companies to do a security audit, to do an assessment, and kind of, you know, see where can we use, let's consolidate our tools and see what we can use that will make the most bang for a buck. So instead, for example, instead of deploying 10 firewalls and throwing everything at the kitchen sink, let's do an audit and see how we can protect ourselves best with 2 firewalls. Do you think that mentality is going to come down to the SMB and to the average American consumer?
I look at it this way. It's like building a house, okay? If your foundation was shaky to begin with and all you do is add paint or add additional concrete or add whatever it is that you think may increase that foundation, it's still going to be shaky. It may shore it up. It may protect it. But the fact is the foundation was shaky to begin with, and it's usually better to get down to the nitty-gritty, get down to the basics. If you can get the basics right, then the additional things that you add will just increase the strength of that strong foundation because you did the basics to begin with. What most people, most companies, most organizations have trouble with is taking their time and getting down into the weeds to understand where their threats really are. I'll give you an example. If you have an organization, we'll say let's 250-person company, and you have a mainframe that's been there for umpteen years. You've got Windows machines that log into the mainframe. You've got maybe Unix machines that are doing something specific having to do with whatever product or service you're offering, so it has to be done on Unix. But everybody in your company understands Windows, so they're using Windows to log in and do their work, but you still have some Unix. Well, now you have 3 different types of technologies. You have mainframe, you have Windows, and you have Unix. What a lot of organizations will do is, rather than going into each one of those technologies, trying to figure out what the risk is for that particular system, they'll just buy a new security suite, throw it in there, and say, we're good. Well, that security suite may be incorrectly configured. It may be looking, as you mentioned, at every alert. Well, you may not need every alert on every single system. Maybe that Unix system has no sensitive information. All it does is check the weather and feeds it into the mainframe. Well, that doesn't need the same security measures that a very sensitive healthcare system may need. So you may need to just configure your monitoring system appropriately, but that takes time, takes effort, it takes understanding what it is that you're looking at, and it takes talking to a consultant like Cyber Protection Services or another cybersecurity subject matter expert to really come in, evaluate it, and say, you really only need to focus on this, and this is what your risk is, and you don't need to throw the kitchen sink at it. Now, to answer your question as far as the home consumer, home consumers should try very, very hard to use a computer for web browsing and a computer for work. The two should not mix. And I say that because oftentimes it's easier to just have all one computer. And if your web browsing computer is compromised, your work computer is probably going to be safe if they're separate. If they're the same, then you're opening yourself up to that liability that we talked about. I think that if a home user ensures that all the patches are up to date, they ensure they have an antivirus, and they take some basic cybersecurity training of, say, don't click on this link, don't fall for this particular scam, and they stay up to date on what the latest scams are, they're not going to need to go on a buying frenzy. They can keep themselves as protected as possible. And if in the event they still get compromised, then they reach out to a cybersecurity person and they can come in and see, this is where you're compromised, this is how I'm going to help you. They should also have a good backup where they've got an external hard drive, they back up their data if it's important to them, pictures, et cetera. They can back up that data on a consistent basis or back it up to the cloud. Cloud is pretty good too, because that is maintained by a third party. They may pay X number of dollars, but if they maintain, again, the basics, training, they're backing up their services, and they're keeping their systems up to date and separating work and home, from my experience, that's the best you can do for a home computer user without having to buy every service that's out there.
Okay, excellent. Now, when we use technology, I mean, TG, let's face it, I mean, technology is touching every aspect of both our professional and personal lives, and probably the best example of this is our smartphone, whether it's an iPhone or an Android. We just can't live without it, right? What are some of the top threats they're facing when we use technology? If you want, you can focus it on the mobile phone if you'd like as a primary example.
Ask that question again. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay, you know, technology is really embracing our lives, right? You know, like the iPhone or the
right.
Android. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just can't live without it, you know, just for both personal and professional communications. What are some of the top threats
mm-hmm.
that we face when using technology in general? And maybe not in general, but if you want to focus on like some of the top threats to mobile devices like the Android or the iPhone, what are some of your thoughts on that?
So one of the things that we do with our phones is we have every different type of application that's on there, from games to applications that we think are going to make our life better. For example, we could have an optical character recognition piece application. What that means is you take a picture of a business card and that information gets put into your contacts rather than you having to type it in. There's thousands, probably millions by now, of different apps that are out there between Android and iOS. The top threats is that user does not know any better of how to look out for apps that are not from reputable companies or check the permissions that you are offering that app to do on your phone. I'll give you an example. I'm researching a product right now, which I can't name, but the product looks very suspicious to me, and it's supposed to improve home cybersecurity. I looked at the application and the permissions that I was off that I had to grant it on my phone in order to allow this product to work effectively. And those permissions essentially gave the developers, if you will, of this app full reign over not only my phone, but also my network. They had full ability and full privileges on my network if I were to download this application and put it on my phone and just say, yes, I need your help. The product may work. However, in doing that, I have essentially opened up a security hole in my home network, in my firewall, because according to the computer, according to the network, I should have full permissions and full rights to my network. My phone should have those full permissions and full networks. Well, now that app also has all of those permissions. So it's like inviting a stranger in to your home, giving him or her the key and say, do whatever you think you need to do, and then leaving the house and not looking at anything that they're doing. That's the number one threat, is that people aren't being trained, aren't learning what threats are out there, and not avoiding the basics, like don't download an app from a company that just started that you don't know. Or if you do that, make sure that you limit the permissions that that app has access to your phone or access to information. I cannot tell you how many people just open themselves up. They'll put a password on their phone. They'll put a biometric lock on their phone, but they'll download an app and give that app complete domain over their phone. It's essentially like not having a password at all.
Well, speaking of which, have you done any work in the biometric technology for like protecting, you know, what being used in like in a multi-factor authentication or as a replacement for passwords?
So multi-factor authentication, talk about that just for a second. That is a real key buzzword, and for those listening probably know what it is, but just so that everybody's on the same page, multi-factor means that you are checking more than one thing. Authentication has to be something you have, something you know, or something you are. Multi-factor means you're using two or three of those things. So something you have means something that's on you, like a common access card, for example. That's something you possess. Something you are is your facial recognition, your fingerprint, your voice authentication. That is something you physically are that is unique to just you. And then something you know is a password. So oftentimes, multi-factor authentication, and we have this with our banks now, they believe that you're always going to have your phone on you. So they need to prove that you have your phone on you. So when you go in and log into your bank from a home computer or computer they don't recognize, they'll send you a code to your phone. That's something you have after you've already put in your password, which is something you know. Those two things are considered multi-factor authentication. With biometrics, instead of sending you that code, they're looking at your fingerprint. They want to make sure that your fingerprint or your facial recognition or voice scan is you. So they need to ensure that not only do you have your password, but your fingerprint matches the fingerprint they have on file. We have done lots of work with companies, specifically federal organizations, with the multi-factor authentication. Not as much in biometrics, because it's very hard to capture everybody's fingerprint or facial recognition. We have done some, but typically it's the common access card or the PIV card, along with, and that's something they have, along with a PIN, a personal identification number, that is matched to that common access card. And that's something that only that person knows, so therefore it's multi-factor authentication. Biometrics and the difference between biometrics and having that code are both of them are still kind of giving you that multi-factor, but multi-factor can still be defeated. It doesn't matter whether you're using the pen or whether you're using the thumbprint. It can still be defeated. So a lot of people think that if I have biometrics, I'm safe. Well, you're safer than having just a password. That's true. But the significance of having the fingerprint over a PIN that you have not shared with anybody is negligible. There's very, very little difference. How it gets defeated is that token can be captured in transit or in some other way of defeating it. So it's a way of having multi-factor is important to have, and it's the best thing that we have thus far. There's actually a few other things that are a little bit better, but we don't have to go into those right now. But I really don't see, we really haven't seen a lot of biometrics that have been implemented that are better than just having that PIV and PIN. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, you did. Actually, I do have a significant background in biometrics, too, so I was kind of wondering what your thoughts on that were, because a lot of people are now thinking that facial recognition is going to be, like, the big thing, but, you know, it still has its many flaws, and I can liken this to 9/11. Right after the World Trade Centers were hit, you know, and the buildings collapsed, about a month later, biometrics is all a big, you know, buzzword, and facial recognition got all the hype. In fact, there are so many VCs pumping in money into these vendors that made facial recognition. It was like the dot-com craze. But once, you know, facial recognition failed to live up to its hype, you know, everybody, you know, poo-pooed the whole idea. And I think we're kind of seeing the same thing now also. Now, I think fingerprint recognition will probably not be one of the best tools of choice now, because it's a contact-related technology, and with the coronavirus, people are kind of now afraid to touch something other people have touched. So I think really iris recognition may be the way to go now in MFA, because, again, it's a non-contactless technology, but people have to overcome that fear, you know, getting your eye scanned, you know. So that's just there are a lot of hurdles for biometrics to overcome before they can be fully adopted here in the United States. But we get into our whole podcast.
There are. A lot of hurdles to overcome. And again, biometrics really just increases the user convenience, because, as you said, you don't have to remember what your thumbprint looks like. You don't have to remember what your iris looks like or what your face looks like. If you have to remember a 6 or 8 digit PIN or multiple PINs for different ways, that's kind of where biometrics trumps having that PIN. But honestly, as far as the security and the back end and that details goes, they're very, very, very similar. There's very little difference as far as how the token is created. Right. It's just a matter of convenience for the user.
Right. And in that regard, I want to tell our audience, you know, don't be, you know, fooled by all these vendor press releases and all the headlines you hear, you know, in the news. Biometrics is great when it works with other sort of security technologies, as you mentioned, but as a standalone, no, don't ever just rely that just on your only means of defense. So I just kind of want to point that out too.
Agreed.
Let's go on to another topic here. In fact, you did talk about passwords. So let's talk about password managers, actually. I know we're kind of going off topic here a little bit, but what are your thoughts on password managers? I mean, do you use one personally? And is there like a top two or three that you recommend for SMB owners to use to maintain?
I try to be program agnostic. I don't try to recommend any particular. There are lots and lots of things out there that you can see that'll show you which one is better versus this one, and every year it's going to change. So I don't recommend anyone in particular. Me personally, I do use a password manager. I like to use Google Chrome that manages a lot of my passwords for my web browsing. And the reason I like Google Chrome is because Google spends millions of dollars every year on their web browser to make it as secure as possible. It's still not perfect. It can still be beaten. However, when connecting my Google Chrome with my Android Chrome and those types of things, I don't necessarily always have to remember what the password is. And the one thing I also like about Google is it will go through and tell me how many times my password is being used on how many sites. If my password has been compromised, it gives me some of that kind of breakdown. There are other password managers out there that kind of do the same thing, but Google Chrome is also free, so it kind of helps, you know, make that decision for me. But again, there are many out there. I highly, highly recommend that everybody use a password manager, because not only will those passwords be changed on a consistent basis, you know, every 90 days you should change your passwords, but you really only have to remember one password, and that password manager will contain those complex passwords and give you the complexity that you need for, you know, one particular website or another.
Okay. Now, this next question is going to kind of be like two sub-questions all kind of mixed in together. Now, late last year, you know, I did some research, wrote an article for a client about fileless malware attacks, and that's essentially where, I think, if I'm correct, the threat variant or the threat whatever vector resides in the memory or the CPU of the computer, if I remember correctly. No.
Okay.
It actually bypasses the antivirus and the anti-malware. So here are two questions for you, DJ. Now, what if you take this example of the fileless malware attack? What happens if a hacker uses this and they're successful? How can SMB recover from the attack? And how does it really evade the antivirus, the anti-malware? And in that regard, why isn't this these software packages enough? What can a SMB owner do on top of having these various things like from Norton or McAfee or Kaspersky or WebRoot?
Okay, well, let's talk about the first one first. The threat vector being in the memory requires some sort of user interaction. And that user interaction typically is they're clicking on a link, opening up some sort of document, or you know, getting something on their computer, whether, you know, maybe they plugged in a USB drive that they shouldn't have, maybe they, you know, downloaded a program or an app that they shouldn't have. Somehow that user grabbed that malware, okay? And the reason oftentimes that the antivirus or anti-malware won't catch it is because it's embedded in some sort of innocuous action that the user is doing. For example, like I just mentioned, downloading or going to a link. And so what ends up happening is that malware is then executed right behind a normal process that the computer recognizes as being, hey, this I'm supposed to be doing this. For example, I'm trying to think of something, put something in a memory register, you know, figure out, compile this program, whatever. Something in that memory register and that executed file is hanging in there because it's behind something that is legit. So the first thing is teach your people how to avoid those threats to begin with, and then you snip it off to begin with. But let's say you have somebody new or you have a temp that doesn't know any better, and now that malware has grabbed hold. Well, the thing that the SMB can do depends on what was compromised, how it was compromised, and the impact. If that malware released, let's say, an inventory of couches for a small furniture company on the web, well, that's not a large impact. Telling everybody how many couches you have in stock, probably not a big deal, right? So the SMB would then go in, wipe that computer, because that memory isn't, that malware was staying in the memory. If you wipe the computer completely, you have a very high probability of getting rid of it completely, and then reload it, and restore from a backup. That's also the next thing you should have. Always, always, always backup your data. Now, backups are easy in theory, difficult to implement in practice. How often do you backup? It will take up resources from your switch and your firewall. It will slow your computer down. How do you back it up? How often should you back it up? Those types of things. And those are all things that a cybersecurity consultant can help a small business owner understand and implement. So once you've restored that computer, you're good to go. Now let's talk about the malware that may have impacted it at a higher level of sensitivity for that information. We'll say it's a small healthcare provider company that, you know, employs maybe two doctors, a couple of nurses, and they've got some health records, and all of a sudden those health records were compromised and then leaked out, and everybody knows, you know, all the patient information of these doctors. This becomes a much more difficult conversation. Number one, that small business owner has to alert their clients of what has happened. They have to then do a thorough sweep of what could potentially happen if that information was used in a nefarious way. Then wiping all of their computers, restoring them from backups, and implementing even stronger security protocols to show their clients that they are, in fact, doing their due diligence in trying to recover from this attack. And most of the time, that's enough. There does come that uncomfortable conversation where legal action may need to be taken by the clients against the small business, and that is a whole different situation. We have to prove that they had a security program in place, they did everything they were supposed to do, but a temp came in and accidentally went to the wrong website because they weren't being trained, and normally that would be enough. But again, it depends on how far that legal action is taken.
Okay. Now, as we have come to the last 15 minutes or so of our show here, TJ, the time has really gone by fast. We've talked about the CNMC in some detail. Now, the other big buzzwords in cyber are artificial intelligence, cybersecurity insurance, and the Internet of Things, also known as the IoT. Can you just give us a quick overview of what are your thoughts on all three of them?
So the Internet of Things is a very broad term, and it primarily is used when you're connecting everything that has some sort of electronic signal, your refrigerator, your microwave, your stove, your thermostat, everything. You're connecting it to Wi-Fi or connecting it to some sort of wireless network or some cases wired network, and that device then has the ability to see other devices within the same premises or in some cases outside the premises if they're connected to other networks. Those Internet of Things have high probability of being attacked because oftentimes they'll have default passwords and users won't change them or won't even understand how to change them. Even vendors that are putting those out aren't creating them with security in mind, although it is getting better in recent years, but some of the older ones really don't have security in mind. Think of Bluetooth. Bluetooth was starting coming into cars in 2007, 2008. However, that Bluetooth did not have any kind of password protection on it whatsoever, and anybody could get into that Bluetooth from those devices back then. Now it's a little bit better. It's still not great. So I tell everybody, if you're going to have things on the Internet or you're going to have things connected to your Wi-Fi, your TV, your tablet, whatever, make sure you stay up to date on the firmware. Make sure that you do change any default passwords on it. And it should be, if possible, on a separate network, not on the network that your home computer is on or your work computer, but a separate, like, guest network to be able to be used so that if it does become compromised, you'll have a firewall that will protect you from an attacker using that as a threat pivot point to get into your network. And, you know, hopefully that firewall can stop it as well. So that's the Internet of Things. As far as cybersecurity insurance or information insurance, they're interchangeable. That is essentially just ensuring that your information is protected in some way, shape, or form. That is a big buzzword, but again, as we talked about, making sure that information stays confidential, stays untouched, and stays available when you need it, right? And I'm sorry, what was that third one that you had asked about?
Artificial intelligence. I'm actually in
artificial
the
intelligence.
Writing. Yeah, I'm in the middle of writing a book right now, and I got to be honest with you. I mean, to use a loose term, it's a very sexy topic for me. I just didn't realize just how deep and just how involved it is. AI is now probably one of the biggest buzzwords. In fact, I think it was probably the biggest buzzword before COVID hit. The cybersecurity landscape's now seeing AI being used, like, you know, for task automation, you know, in pen testing, threat hunting exercises. And it's also being used to kind of filter out for the, the false positives and threats and warnings that inundate, you know, IT security teams. And also, one last thing, it's being used to help project what the future threat landscape would look like. Because, you know, there's a lot of data that's coming in, a lot of big data, and for an individual to comb through all that makes statistical extrapolations, it would take days. And, of course, we know the cyber threat landscape is changing minute by minute, and this is where AI can really be its biggest boon. What are your thoughts on AI, and have you even used AI for your services and for your clients, for the SMBs?
So I agree with you. I think AI is a big buzz term. I think AI is going to allow us to do things that we've never thought possible, because AI is based on, in most cases, there are a couple exceptions. Google's actually making an exception now. But in most cases, it's based on statistical analysis. For example, if you get up and go to work every morning and you leave your house by 7 a.m. and it takes you 39 minutes to get to work on average, that average is based on when it rains, how many people are on the road, how fast you drive, whether you stop to get coffee. And those, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of variables that all can be calculated into when looking at that average. What AI does is it looks at all those variables very, very well and can come up with the statistical means very, very quickly. The problem with some AI applications is that old term, garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
There have been a lot of studies that shown that AI has great applications. However, if the information going into the algorithm is biased, then the information coming out of the algorithm is not going to be 100%. And one of the issues, especially in cybersecurity, is how do you ensure that the information going into your AI algorithm or your AI solution is not biased? And when I say biased, what's considered a false positive to one company may not necessarily become identified as a false positive for another company. And then it goes back to behaviors. If you have let's say an organization that a computer has been compromised and has a bot that's been installed, and that bot has gone undetected for months. Well, behavior-based analytics would not catch that bot ever, because that bot is essentially just part of the network traffic, and AI is looking at the network traffic that it's been normal and since it's been installed. So therefore, it's not going to catch unless that bot all of a sudden starts working overtime or working harder. That bot can remain undetected for as long as that system is there. So I think it goes back to what I said earlier. We need to have the basics done right first. We need to build that foundation. We need to understand what the threat levels are. We need to understand what the threats are. Oftentimes, there's a lot more insider threats than people realize. And that's not to say that they are malicious insider threats. They're just people or processes that are not designed with security in mind, usually efficiency or profitability, top security. So therefore, security is left kind of unconfigured or configured incorrectly. And if that remains to be the mentality, then no solution, including AI, is really going to be the best defense. If companies build up a security program from the ground up and do the things, and let me tell you, it's tedious. I bet you if you ask 10 people how often they go through and make sure that all their windows are locked in their homes and their doors are locked in their homes and that their security cameras are working correctly and capturing information and then deleting the information that is innocuous, like, you know, the people living there, probably 9 out of 10 of them would say that they weren't doing those every single day. And that's a problem because that means there is a security hole at some point during that day. AI is kind of the same thing. If you don't have the basics in to begin with, then you have garbage in and you have garbage out, and you may be missing the threats that are the most severe.
Right. In fact, I think in chapter one I wrote about, you know, this is really where the issue, the robustness of the data sets come into play. You've really got to check to make sure that your data is as robust as you can get it to be, and to kind of do like a test run of what the outputs would be to make sure you kind of get what you want the predicted outcome to be. So I kind of wrote that it's important to get this in a sandbox environment before you actually put out in the production environment. But yeah, it's very interesting that you say that. Now, just two more questions before we wrap up our show, TJ. You may have talked about this before, but I'm going to kind of ask you to elaborate again. What is the one cybersecurity threat that's going to happen this year or maybe next year? Absent COVID ID, we've seen so many things happen. And do you have a laundry list of topics? I mean, not topics, but of tips that you give to SMBs as to how they could protect themselves from mitigating the risk of being a victim of a cyber attack?
I don't know about a laundry list, but I'll answer that one first, and I'll come back to the number one threat. So make sure that your people are trained. Make sure that you have some sort of disaster recovery in place, because not all threats come from hackers. You know, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, fires, those are all still real threats, and those are all still things that can wipe your business out. There are ways to minimize those risks if you have a good, robust disaster recovery plan. And make sure that you build in processes that have security as a top priority. It doesn't have to be the number one priority. You know, certainly profitability needs to be the priority for all small businesses so that they can continue to expand and grow. But security has to be up there. And if we live in a bubble, we'll never get attacked, but we'll never go anywhere either. There has to be some balance between security and usability. That's true. However, they really should be equal. And depending on what type of business you're in, try to ask yourself, what would happen if, and then fill in the blank. What would happen if my data got out? What would happen if my data got deleted and I couldn't get it back? What would happen if my data got changed without me knowing about it? And then ask yourself how much money it would cost to rebuild after that were to be realized, after that threat were to be realized. If the answer is anything but I could recover in a day and it wouldn't cost me very much, then reach out to a cybersecurity professional and at least have that conversation. Most companies will give you a complimentary evaluation for free. So those are the types of things. We shouldn't be like lawyers where you only call us when you need us, when you need them. We should be that managed partner where we grow with you and help create a customized solution for you depending on your business needs. A grocery store doesn't need the same security level as a health care provider. And to go back to your first question of what's the number one threat this year next, I'll tell you. Trying to get something for nothing or get something significantly discounted, meaning somebody contacts you, wants to offer you free money, free gift card, or a severely discounted car, or laptop, or some sort of product. The old adage holds very true. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. Never click on a link from anything that you get an email that you didn't ask for. Careful about the documents that you open. And I always tell people, have a couple different email accounts. Have one for retail shopping, that, you know, anytime somebody wants you to sign up for their email distribution list, have a separate email for that. Have one for friends and family. Don't share that with any retailer. Just, you know, friends and family that want to send you emails or pictures of the grandkids. And then have one as a professional email. Even if you have your own work account, you should still have a professional email. So if you need to do some sort of professional business in some way, shape, or form, like with your attorney or with another professional, that professional email will go back and forth. Is it tedious to have three separate emails? Yes, it is. But most phones and most web browsers or email solutions will allow you to attach multiple different emails so you can just monitor it that way. And that will help at least thwart against some of those threats that are coming, because the biggest threat we have are the users. And that's the one thing we can't get rid of.
Okay. Well, TJ, we thank you very much for your time this afternoon. I think it was one of the best podcasts I've had. You really shed a lot of insight onto other realms of cybersecurity, which I have not even thought of or even asked a previous guest on podcast before. Thanks for your time. We'd like to have you very much again on another show here in the near future, if you have the time.
I do have the time, and it'd be an honor. And Ravi, I appreciate you inviting me, and, you know, look forward to coming back. Thanks again.
Thanks. Stay safe. Have a good weekend, okay?
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.